From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2007 when a team of teachers and students were in Canandaigua trying to unearth some local history. It sounds like a big undertaking, an archaeological dig looking for fragments of our past. And in fact, the old Billings blacksmith shop left remains in the soil that go back some 200 years. But it's not necessarily an unusual event for Ann Morton of Archaeological Research Services. For the past two decades, Morton has been teaching how to work with the soil and helping us understand our history, how to delicately handle what we do find. As the Finger Lakes Times witnessed that day, a student of Morton's discovered a shard of pottery from a trench on that Canandaigua dig site. How can you tell what kind of pottery it is? Well, you lick it, I guess. And unfortunately for the student, it tasted like the inside of a toilet bowl. Well, that's part of the process of archaeology. And tonight, Ann Morton is giving a presentation on how archaeology can connect us to our history. She's going to give that presentation at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. But first, she's with us here on Connections, and it's great to have you, Ann. Thank you so much.
Thank you for asking me to come.
This is exciting for me. It's exciting for my three-year-old son, who was digging at the Seneca Park Zoo on their little fossil site and loved it. And even in advance of this program, we've heard from so many different listeners on questions about what archaeology means locally. And I opened the hour by saying, you know, for me, you hear archaeology and I think Australopithecus afarensis and Johansson and Lucy and all of these great things. But I don't necessarily think local archaeology. I guess there's more underneath our feet than we realized.
Actually, in this part of New York State, we are sitting on some of the most dense and most interesting archaeology anywhere in the state. We rival the Hudson Valley for what we have here, both in terms of Native American. We are a center for Native American groups. The Genesee is one of the rivers in terms of how people moved and how people lived their lives. But in terms of historic development, the major historic events that happen in this area. And for us, archaeology really is anything from as far back as you can remember up until last week. once it's gone, it's part of the archaeological record.
And my assumption before the hour began, I was talking to Anne and said, well, even if we could find remains, whatever is left, you know, it would be much more modern creatures, I assumed. You wouldn't find dinosaurs, etc. And Anne stopped me and said, well, hold on. And I said, wait a second here. What would we find under our feet right around here?
Oh, well, you're right next to some of the major industrial development in Rochester. I mean, literally, the building is sitting on them. The Rochester Museum and Science Center did a number of excavations right in this area and uncovered the early industrial history, the industrial history that really drives the development of the city of Rochester, and that's directly below you. So prehistoric? Oh, yeah. Go back 10,000 years, right along the gorge here. There's prehistory going back 10,000 years. Before that, we were talking a little bit about this when we first came in, the glaciers have removed most of the material that would be that great Jurassic Park age. It's just not here, but certainly go back even further than that, and we have a lot of ancient fossils and finds, particularly things like diatoms and crinoids. So the history in this area goes back as far as you want to go. And if your three-year-old dug in the ground, he would almost certainly find something. It might not be a million years old, but it could easily be 100 or even 1,000 or maybe more than that.
And how far down do we have to go here? Again, my assumption was farther down than most of us would have the stamina to go. And I guess not necessarily the case, huh?
Not at all. Now, if we were to dig below this building, because we're in an urban setting and people have basements, we'd have to go further. But if you went out into a field somewhere nearby, 2-3 feet, that's about it. The whole of the last 10 to 12,000 years of history in this part of upstate New York, largely built up in the top 2 to 3 feet.
I'm talking to Ann Morton from Morton Archaeological Research Services, and some of what we're going to be talking about is not only what you might find, but how to recognize what it is, which is such an interesting question for so many of us. Anne is presenting tonight as part of the Science on the Edge series for the Rochester Museum and Science Center. It starts at 7:30 if you want to attend, and tickets are available at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. Doors open at 6:30, 7:30 tonight for this presentation on local archaeology. And I mentioned that 2007 dig with the students and the piece of pottery. You lick a piece of pottery, Ashar?
Yes, you do. My crew always teases me that when we find something like that and they'll say, well, what is it? I said, well, just stick it in your mouth. The reality is that different tempers of pottery stick to your tongue differently. So if you have a piece of whiteware, which is a relatively low-fired, low-tempered pottery, stick it to your tongue and it'll stick. Ironstone, which is popular from the mid-1800s onward, because it's more durable, it's higher fired, doesn't stick, but it does taste like you're licking the inside of a porcelain toilet. It's a nasty, nasty experience, but it'll tell you immediately what the fabric of the pottery is. So just stick it in your mouth.
And the difference in ages, is there a difference on when those would have been made?
There can be. Whiteware is invented or created earlier, but it continues. You can still buy whiteware now. Ironstone is developed a little later. It's preferred for applications where you don't want your dishes to break or break as often. Whiteware breaks a little more easily. When ironstone first becomes available, it's a little more expensive. So it's a higher class of ware than your whitewares. But they both continue right on to the present day, and you can buy them. But it is helpful for us to at least begin to get some sense of what the dates of sites might be, knowing the difference in the two different kinds, those two different kinds of pottery.
If you've got questions or comments about this subject, it's such a good subject. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Ann Morton of Morton Archaeological Research Services is here, and Ann, Morton Archaeological Research Services is based where?
It's my company, and it's actually based in Macedon.
Okay.
I started it in 1996, so almost 30 years ago, which was kind of a...
That's just 20 years.
20 years. Sorry, almost 20 years. Good. Don't ask me to do math on the radio.
You were told there would be no math then.
No math.
So about 20 years ago.
About 20 years ago, which was kind of a surprise to me. And we do primarily archaeology in advance of construction projects. The National Historic Preservation Act that was created in 1966 asks state and local federal agencies to consider what they're going to do and how it might impact archaeological sites, whether it might destroy a site or not. Now, it doesn't say that they can't do it, but they have to think about it. And so as part of the whole permitting process for any construction, whether you're putting in a new road or you're putting up a Walmart, we look at the archaeology in the same way that they look to see about what animals might be disturbed or how the noise levels might change or how traffic might increase. And we do that part of the permitting for construction projects across New York State.
So, for example, they want to put a Walmart in somewhere, and it's a largely undeveloped site. You will do what?
We'll do what we call a phase one. And that comes in two parts. It's a 1A, where we go and we research the background of that site. So we try to figure out everything that we can know about that piece of ground without actually putting a shovel in it, including walking over it and looking to see if there are clues in the landscape, the way the ground dips and bumps, or the kinds of plants that exist. And then we'll, if we think it's necessary, and if the agencies that we work with think it's necessary, then we'll go and dig what we call shovel test holes. An awful lot of archaeology is really basic, and a shovel test hole is a hole you dig with a shovel. And it's about 5 widths of a shovel blade around, and you dig it down as deep as you can go, which is usually about 2 to 3 feet. By the time you get down 3 feet, you can't really reach your arm to the bottom anymore. And we'll look to see what kinds of material is in there. That'll tell us whether there is or is not a site, a place where human activity took place. And it'll also give us an idea, hopefully, of the type and age of that site and who might have created it or used it. From there, we figure out what the construction project might or might not need to do about what we found.
We're getting some listener feedback already, and I will be getting to your phone calls in just a moment. David and Lisa in Rochester, we'll get to you in just a moment, but let me kind of follow up on this question because I find this so interesting now. Will you, when you're working at a site like that, after a shovel test, and depending on what you find, is it part of your job to advise in any way about, you know, are they asking you, should we not build here at all? Or, you know, do we need to excavate more of this site? What do they ask you?
It's a cooperative process between me as the archaeologist, the client, and usually their engineer, and a federal and state agencies that are involved. What they'll ask me is to try to tell them what I think was happening here in the past. And so I'll say, well, I think you have a historic farm here. It probably dates to the early 1800s, for example. And based on the records, I know that the person who was farming here is also a prominent county judge. And so there could have been important people coming to the house. We might want to think about whether this is a site we want to either avoid, which means that we change the project so nothing happens mm-hmm. there, or whether we want to do a little more research. We can't really have a developer not work in that space, avoid it, unless we know that that site really is significant. And the significance is determined by the federal and state agencies we work with. We provide the information.
Sure.
And our best judgment, and that allows them to then make a determination. But it's very largely a cooperative process between all the parties who are involved.
Most of what you find, I imagine, are small fragments. I mean, I'm having a hard time assuming that you're going to unearth some perfectly preserved something in the ground. But have you had wow moments?
Well, funnily enough, the dig that you started with in Canandaigua, which was the Billings Blacksmith Shop on Main Street, we knew that it had ceased to exist about 1911. We suspected that it had been put in about 1800, but we really didn't know much about it. We peeled back the ground literally inches, and the forge was intact directly below
Wow.
it. The top stack had been taken off, but everything below that was completely intact, including all the tools lying on the floor in the position where they'd been left. And we had the anvil stump. I mean, you just peeled back the ground, and there it all was. And it's rare that you see a site like that, but that was phenomenal. And so it can happen. You can find everything. When we even have the key to the door.
What a moment. Even for you, having done so many of these digs, that has to be a remarkable moment.
Yeah, that was a wow moment. And we actually had some fellows came out from New York State Museum who'd also been working on blacksmith shops and showed them what we were working on, and they just stood there with their jaws hanging down. It was so impressive.
Let me grab a phone call, and this is Lisa in Rochester. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hi. I was wondering if you happen to know what might have been found at the excavation of the Costco site, because it's one of the highest points around in the area, and I assume it's contiguous with the trail that was used by the Native Americans that went across Pinnacle Hill and into Mount Hope Cemetery.
I don't actually know what was found there. I do know a little bit about the trail, and you're right, it is one of the trails that is one of the main access points going across Rochester. There's a series of trails, of course, which you probably know, that go up the Genesee, and then trails which travel east-west. And they're all important access routes. They all have some degree of Native American activity on them, although it varies. Some of it is just temporary campsites, stopping off places. And then you have more wildly spaced sort of not really permanent, but more permanent areas. And then, of course, things connect to permanent settlements. But that one in particular, I don't know anything more about. But now I'm going to have to go home and look it up and see what I can find out.
Do you know if there's a repository or somewhere where you can search to find out, you know, is it recorded what's found in an area?
Well, one of the first things that you can do, and again, we were talking about this before the program started, the New York State Parks maintains something called the Cultural Resource Information System, or CRIS. It is a publicly available database. It's online, and anyone can sign in as a guest, and you can put in an address, and it will show you not the specific location of an archaeological site, but it'll show you whether an area is archaeologically sensitive, and it will show you historic buildings that are in the area, and it'll tell you whether or not they're on the National Register. And so that's a starting place, and anybody can put in any address. You can put in your house and see if you're in an archaeologically sensitive area. Once you get that information, you can go to New York State Parks and ask more questions, or to the New York State Museum, or here in Rochester, the Rochester Museum and Science Center, and they would have more information about what's known about potential sites in that area.
Lisa, I hope I answered your question. Great question, and you're starting to see what a great resource Ann Morton is. If you want to see more of her presentation tonight, 7:30 at the Rochester Museum and Science Center for their lecture series, and the doors open at 6:30 there. Tickets available, and the most expensive ticket, I think it's $15. So it's not an expensive ticket, and there's so much to discover in this. Ann and I were talking before the hour, and I feel like there's so many different ways we could take the conversation. But we're going to let our listeners help with that, too. That was a great question from Lisa. This is Mike in Rochester. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, hi, Lisa. I was curious. You were talking about the different types of survey that you're doing, and you're doing the above-ground survey as well as the testing and the, mm-hmm. and the pits and whatnot. I was curious about what kind of environmental data you're able to pull out of that. And how you're integrating that into the findings that you find.
Well, that's an interesting question, because the way that we're collecting environmental data is actually changing. In the past, we tended to pick up less information than we do now. And certainly when we're doing that first set of shovel testing, the environmental data that we're picking up is relatively simple. We're looking at the different layers and levels in the ground. We're doing some basic things like checking soil color, checking soil type. But we're now becoming aware, particularly with the potential of things like the ability to read DNA, that we need to start actually taking some soil samples, because we can potentially test the soil for all kinds of DNA, not just human DNA, but all kinds of plant and animal DNA and bacterial DNA. And that will tell us an awful lot more about the development of plant and animal life in that area, can tell us about seasonality, what time of year it is. I mean, there's just an enormous number of things. So we're starting to think more about that.
It's very interesting. It would be, it would definitely be interesting to get that kind of perspective in regards to the plant life and the environmental, mm-hmm. The actual environment of the area back in that time period. You guys do any integration into like a GIS system as well?
We are definitely moving in that direction. I mean, archaeology really has always done GIS. Right. We've just done it on paper. We've always built complex maps where we interleaved things. Now, with the potential of GIS systems, we do a great deal more of that.
GIS stands for?
Graphic Information Systems. Okay. It's a visual database. So you can take, say you take your modern Google map of an area, and then you can actually do this for free on Google. You pull in a historic map, and Google will actually let you drop the historic map right on top of the existing map. So you can see how today's structures and structures in the past fit together. With a GIS system, you could also pull in a soil map and drop that on now and see, okay, where are they putting the houses? Is that good farmland or less good farmland? Where is it likely that they would have, say, put the cemetery? Because most people don't want to put cemeteries in two places. One is where it's really wet, because you can kind of see where that's going.
Yes.
You really don't want the bodies floating up to the surface.
Yes.
And the other is where you have good farmland, because you're going to want to farm that. So we can interleave that. And mm-hmm. so your GIS for us has just been it's a tremendous tool. And we're really starting to make more and more use of that, particularly in trying to figure out where sites could be.
And Tom in Neptune, New Jersey, wanted to know, his question was, do they take x-rays of the ground, and how closely do you work with environmentalists and underground storage tanks? So, interesting question. But we talked a little bit about working with environmentalists just now. X-rays of the ground?
We do occasionally. Okay. We use ground-penetrating radar occasionally as well. It's very useful in some locations. I have friends of mine who are working out in Ohio where ground-penetrating radar really lets them get a very nice picture of what was there thousands of years ago. In places here in upstate New York, the rocks and the soil don't really allow us to do that quite so well. And I'm not that kind of a scientist, so I let them tell me whether I can use it or not and do the readings on it. One of the nice things about archaeology is we work with all kinds of other people. Mm-hmm. Storage tanks underground, that is something that we have to worry about, and there are scientists who specifically handle those kinds of queries, and we frequently do work with them on construction projects because that's something you don't want to run into, and engineers particularly don't want to run into.
Well, allow me to ask an ignorant question then. Storage tanks storing what exactly?
Usually some kinds of oil or gas.
Yeah, okay.
And you find them in urban settings quite often. I did a project up on Ridge Road where just about every other corner had a turn-of-the-century gas station on it. Mm-hmm. They'd been blacksmith shops, and blacksmiths kept their lifestyle going forward by becoming auto shops, by becoming gas stations. If you drive there now, you'll notice quite a few of those are not there anymore, but they still have all kinds of remains in the ground, including their storage tanks.
Yikes. Let me get back to the phones and grab Andy in Greece. Go ahead, Andy.
Hi, Evan. How you doing?
Good.
I was just calling to say that I actually, in response to Lisa's question earlier, I actually was the archaeologist on the CityGate project.
Very good.
Used to work for the Russia Museum and Science Center, and we now have a company called Archaeological Consulting Experts. Mm-hmm. But wanted to call and just say that we did actually find some historic material in there, nothing prehistoric, but obviously since it was historic structures, we found a lot of ceramics, a lot of nail. Mm-hmm. Actually did find one piece of ceramic that had the Iolas Sanatorium writing on the rim of the plate.
Nice.
Wow. And Andy, help us understand, when you find that kind of material, what do you do with it?
Well, usually that material ends up getting curated. I believe that actually is with the museum currently. And a lot of the contracts that we go through, the client that we have is responsible for having that material curated. So usually it goes to a museum or some sort of research institution.
And to Lisa's questions on what you might have found, it doesn't sound like you found anything that would have inhibited development there.
No, nothing real significant. Just your run-of-the-mill ceramics and pieces of nail and broken pieces of bottle glass.
Well, let me ask Andy and Ann that same question then, because we already had a couple questions on Twitter. People are essentially asking, what am I going to find in my backyard? Everybody lives in a different place. I don't know the answer to that. Andy, what do you expect to find when you do a dig like you did on the CityGate site, for example?
It really depends on what the location that you're working in. I live in Greece, so generally anything that you're working north of Ridge Road, you're going to end up hitting a lot of shells because that used to be glacial lakes. Mm-hmm. Along Ridge Road, you find a lot more native sites since that was a trade route. But it really depends on the situation. Industrial areas, you're going to find a lot of historic stuff. We've been doing a lot of roadside projects lately, which unfortunately you're only working about 10 feet away from the edge of pavement, and you tend to find a lot of garbage.
Yeah,
that's true.
Andy, what's the name of your company again?
It's Archaeological Consulting Experts. It's acearchaeology.com.
Cool stuff.
And we've been in business for, I think this is the third year.
Well, thank you for filling us in on the CityGate and answering Lisa's question, and thanks for calling in, Andy.
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Well, so he's talking about what he expects to find, for example, and, you know, to the backyard question. People probably ask you this all the time. What am I going to find in my backyard? I don't know if there's an easy answer, but what do you say?
There are a variety of things. Just as Andy said, it really does depend on your location. And sometimes your backyard is not what you expect it to be. We did a big project in the city of Utica, and you would think in the middle of downtown Utica in the street, you'd find a lot of utilities and a lot of fill, and you do. But remember that backyards have not always been backyards, and front yards have not always been front yards. Things have built up over time. In this particular part of the project, we found that what is a street now used to be people's backyards. And so when the pavement came up and the sidewalks came up, we had all kinds of backyard deposits. Now, this is historic material, so we had a lot of what are called middens or dumps. And dump is the common word. Midden is the very archaeological word.
M-I-D-D-E-N.
M-I-D-D-E-N, for trash.
Okay.
Before there are garbage trucks that come around and pick up your trash, people are responsible for getting rid of their trash by themselves, and usually they throw it away somewhere on their property. If you live out in a farm area, there's plenty of places that you can get rid of your trash, and most of us who've lived in rural areas can remember the trash pile somewhere on the property. If you live in a suburban or an urban area particularly, you're more limited in where you can get rid of your trash, and so you tend to bury your trash in the back part of your property. And if you work in the city of Utica, as several of us have, you tend to find rather spectacular trash heaps in these backyards.
Going back how long?
These were going back about 150 years, maybe a little bit more, to primarily to the middle 1800s.
And part of the presentation tonight focuses on A Tale of Two Middens, right?
Yes. If you work in archaeology, you do tend to spend an awful lot of time working with other people's trash. So, but trash can tell you amazing things. Among other things, we tend to think of, in this case, this part of Utica, which today is not one of the most desirable areas, but at the time in which we were dealing with the trash, this was an area where doctors and lawyers and businessmen were living, and also where there were a lot of boarding houses for sales clerks and banking assistants and dressmakers and a whole section of widows who had a very genteel lifestyle where their husband was alive, but now that he'd passed and there's no Social Security, there's no Medicare, there's no Medicaid, they need to find a more reduced but still nice place to live. So we found things like dice for parcheesi boards and some very interesting faunal remains that suggest these people ate the more expensive cuts of meat. We found a lot of clothing buttons for nicer clothing. And we also found the remains of things like the pieces that had come out of a jewelry shop where the jewelry was being repaired. So we had a lot of jewelry on this project, which is not something we normally see.
Tonight, Anne is presenting at 7:30 at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. Tickets are available. Doors open at 6:30. It's part of their lecture series, and they bring in various experts in different fields locally. And we've had so much fun talking about on this program what they do. Anne Morton is with Morton Archaeological Research Services. And after this very short break, we're going to get back to your phone calls. David on Twitter wants to know, what's the best way to find a place to dig with my kids? He says, we live on an old farm, so we'll get David's question in as well. And we'll talk a little bit about the way that this kind of archaeological service locally can maybe tell you more about, yeah, what was happening on that site with a family, et cetera. But can we also learn more about our own local history and discovering more of the broader picture? So much to talk about with Anne Morton. Let's get that short break and right back here on Connections. And coming up on Friday on Connections, want to let you know that we're going to be talking about the urban-suburban program. So much talk in the last year about local districts expanding that. We'll tell you all about what's going on in urban-suburban. Then in our second hour, It's a preview of three film festivals. It's festival season here in Rochester. We're going to talk High Falls, Image Out, and the Rochester Jewish Film Festivals, all previewed tomorrow. That's coming up Friday on Connections.
Research shows that employers tend to hire people like themselves. So how can hiring managers get past that bias?
Wow, I think if I just saw his resume on my desk, I don't know if I would have selected him.
A Texas entrepreneur has come up with a way to help managers see past their biases. Blind job auditions later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Welcome back to Connections. It's 844-295-TALK if you want to join the conversation with Ann Morton of Morton Archaeological Research Services. 844-295-8255. That number is toll-free or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Let's get to David's question. David wants to know about the best way to find a place to dig with my kids. He says, we live on an old farm and want to know what the best way is to find a place to dig with my kids.
There are a number of avenues, but one of the ones that I would suggest you try first, New York State has two great archaeological associations. One of them is the New York State Archaeological Association, and the other is the New York Archaeological Council. Both of them have local presence. The New York State Archaeological Association has 17 chapters across the state, and they are open to all ages. And in fact, we encourage parents and children to join them, but to get in touch with them. A lot of them run local archaeological programs, and they would be more than happy to direct you to programs in your area and to provide assistance with understanding how the archaeological process works. And I'm now going to blank. The president of the association is going to have my head because I can't remember the website address.
It's okay. What's the name of the association?
New York State Archaeological Association. And I think the web is nyarchaeology.org.
If it's not, though, Google will help us find it.
Yes, Google will help you find
it. New York State Archaeology. And that was a great question, David. I think that's, again, I said earlier in the hour, my three-year-old loves digging wherever we go. But I'd never thought about actually using that kind of a resource to find spots to dig. So that's a lot of fun. And some of what you're talking about tonight in this Tale of Two Middens is the stories we learn about something that our past, say, 200 years ago. The story of the two middens in Bristol, right? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, one of them is in Bristol and the other one is in Macedon.
Okay.
And I have to say this was not a story I intended to tell, but it sort of became something that I realized I needed to talk about, both from a sense of how we understand how people create trash, and also from understanding what it tells us about some of the cycle of people's lives. And I'm trying not to say too much because it's all in the talk tonight. But middens can tell us a great deal about individual people, but they can also tell us how individual people responded to the events that are happening around them. To give you an example that's not from my talk,
sure. Mm-hmm.
There's been a long-running program, I believe it's coming out of University of Arizona, called the Garbage Archaeology Project. And Bill Rathjay and his students have been collecting literally people's trash and going through it to see how people throw things away. What kinds of things do people throw away on a daily basis and in what format? Then to think about that, you mean how much meat do they buy that's coming in little plastic packets and how often do they get meat that they have to take apart and how do they process it? They've actually ended up becoming consultants to people who have to deal with municipal waste all around the world. But one of the things that you find out when you actually look at people's trash is that people don't necessarily do what they say they do or what you would think they do. For example, people tend to underrepresent how many bottles of alcohol they go through in a week.
Yes, we know that surveys always underrepresent, yes.
The other thing that they found out during periods where, for example, meat, especially higher cuts of meat, was scarce or very expensive, you saw more of that meat being dumped in the trash, which doesn't really make any sense until you stop and think about it. What they realized was that people were panic buying, often cuts of meat that they wouldn't normally eat, and maybe didn't even know how to prepare, and they couldn't actually consume it, and so it was getting wasted and thrown away. And it was a result of the people's anxiety about whether or not they would be able to get this particular meat that was rare and high status, more expensive than what they would normally eat.
Interesting. Well, Gary writes to us and says, fascinating discussion. I doubt I'd find much in my yard, but how can we make sure that whatever we do find, we handle appropriately? That's an interesting question, Gary.
It is. It's a good question. There are several things to keep in mind when you're handling archaeological material. An awful lot of what you dig up is going to be, in all likelihood, historic glass or pottery or bricks, other fragments of building materials, and most of that is fairly stable. What would be perfectly good for you to do would be to wash it with a toothbrush gently in cold water and dry it on paper towels, and then store it somewhere where it's not going to be banged around. Other things, metals, bone, paper, leather, these are much more fragile and sometimes require special handling in order that they not start to decay. Things that have been in the ground, especially if they've been in the ground where it's damp, once they come up into the air, that decay process will start right away. There are a number of resources, both in print and on the internet, that will give you some guidelines for how to handle material. And there are also experts. The museum, New York State Museum, Rochester Museum and Science Center have experts who can answer questions about how should I handle this shoe that I dug up in my backyard, or what should I do with this paper object? How should I take care of it so that it will continue to have a long life? So those will both sort of help you, guide you in how to take care of your objects.
I think it was a good question, Greg. Ed writes to us and actually sent us pictures. Ed says, I have a late archaic camp in my backyard in West Webster, discovered while digging a post hole for a fence in May of 2012, working with an archaeologist to unearth it. Yard was the site of a gully that was filled in for development of a housing subdivision in the early 1950s. And he sends some photos. Late archaic refers to the period?
Yes, late archaic is a time period. We divide up the prehistoric, the pieces that come before history, before written history, into different periods. And late archaic would be, dates are not my favorite thing, about 4,000 or 5,000 years ago.
Wow, and he is sending pictures of what look like stone tools and arrowheads, perhaps?
It could well be.
Mm-hmm. Really fascinating stuff. Thank you, Ed. Thanks for sending that. Wow. How common is that kind of a discovery? You're digging a post hole, putting a fence in.
In this part of the world, actually, it's far more common than you would think. I was working with a woman at an engineering firm, and she lives down in Lima direction, and she used to bring me things from her garden all the time. She would be out gardening, putting in a bit of rockery or some plants, and up something would come, and she'd come in and say, is this a rock or is this a... And I'm like, no, that's a grinding stone. You have a site where you're living. Because this area is really densely settled by Native American populations, and then densely settled in the historic period, we do find things quite often. You'll find remains. That's, and I take a step back and say that's not to say that people lived everywhere on the landscape, but it's more common than you'd think that things will come up in people's yards.
That's why Ann Morton will probably never run out of work for Morton Archaeological Research Services. She's my guest for the hour, and tonight at 7:30, she's presenting at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. It's A Tale of Two Middens, and she's given you a bit of a taste of what's going on. Not the kind of taste that you'd want if you lick a piece of pottery. That's not the kind of taste you'd want. But no. Anne is going to be presenting tonight. Tickets are available 7:30, and the doors open at 6:30. It's a nice, relaxed setting, and you can see how much interest there is in the subject. I did want to make sure that I asked Anne about a subject that has been in the world news this week. Because we've been talking about Western New York and what we find here. But a lot of attention in archaeology around the world right now is looking at Syria. And we're used to saying it Palmyra, though I imagine in Syria they pronounce it Palmyra, but it is the one of the great sites of antiquity that ISIS has now captured. And there is concern about what they're going to do with a huge amount of items that have survived, beautiful structures that are largely preserved. First of all, as an archaeologist, are you concerned?
Oh, yeah. There are a lot of us who are just sitting here holding our breath. We are hoping that this will not happen, but a lot of us are not desperately hopeful.
You're worried they're going to destroy some of that?
We're worried on two levels. We are worried that they're going to destroy it. They have destroyed other things, and so that's a very real possibility. We're also worried about it being looted. So people may remember the looting that took place during the Iraq War. And archaeologists around the world responded by trying to get inventories, create lists of stuff which had been taken, and try to keep an eye out for that, keep in touch with one another and see as things surface to try to help get things back where they belonged. And people certainly will be concerned at this point that that may happen, but even more so that it'll just be outright destroyed. Looting and selling it's an awful thing, but it at least has some sort of an obvious function in order to use these items to obtain funding to be able to do something else. But wholesale destruction, that's just a different, it's a different level of event. That's a different kettle of fish. We were talking a little bit at the very beginning, and I said, Evan had asked me about what I thought might happen. And I said, you know, the thing about wholesale destruction is that it disconnects people from their past. You lose that sense of belonging to the stream of history. You lose a sense of who you are, because part of who you are is that series of events that's have led up to you being here now, your connection to your ancestors, to the places that you've lived, to those events gets broken. And that can be really disjarring and destructive for a community, for a nation, to lose that sense of who they are. So,
and when it comes to looting and selling, how good of a list, how good of lists exist now? Do we know? Do archaeologists around the world have a sense for what could be out there?
I'm not sure how good the lists are. I know that there are many archaeologists who participate and contribute and try to keep up with one another in terms of knowing where things are located. And there are national and international laws governing the sale of objects. But the reality is that people who want to take objects and sell them and realize profit often do find a way. But we're those of us who care about the history of these places, the history of the object, the history of the people that they represent. I know sometimes people think archaeologists really are interested only in stuff. We're interested in how neat and valuable that stuff is. And we do like that. We do like neat, valuable stuff. But archaeologists are primarily interested in objects because they are what is left to tell us about people. And not just a broad group of people, but individuals who really lived, who had real everyday lives, who cared about things, who loved things, who laughed, who had families, who had bad days and good days. Those objects are what we have left to tell who they were. It's the last chance that we have to have those people's lives speak. And so having those objects lost is like really losing those people permanently.
If an item is sold, looted and sold, is there a low likelihood it will ever be seen again? Or is there a chance that it will surface because if someone buys an object from antiquity, and perhaps they don't want to simply keep it for themselves, maybe they would want to leverage it, sell it to a museum. So I guess that's part of the hope, is that they would surface again?
There's a hope that they will surface again, and that's why we maintain lists and maintain contacts and try to keep an eye out for these objects so that if something that's been looted resurfaces somewhere where we can become aware of it, where the various different people can become aware of it, hopefully it can be repatriated to where it belongs. They've actually done quite a lot of this with material that was looted during World War II, and there's been a real concerted effort to get objects repatriated back to the place where they belong. And it would be my hope that that would happen here. If it's wholesale destruction, then there's just not going to be a whole lot that we can really do.
Yeah. We're talking to Ann Morton for a few more minutes, and you can see her tonight at the Rochester Museum and Science Center with her presentation at 7:30. I mentioned that my son at the age of 3 has decided he wants to be an archaeologist. I'm sure that will change many times. Mm-hmm. But for kids who are interested, I think, again, as parents, I'm just much more used to growing up reading about the big dig sites around the world in Africa, et cetera. But archaeology as a career, what do you think?
Well, it's what I've been doing for almost 30 years now. I have to say it's a lot of fun. It's the most fun that I can imagine having being at work. It's different all the time. It's great if you like physical things because you can be out in the field and be digging. It's exciting to touch things that people haven't held or touched or looked at in maybe hundreds, maybe thousands of years. It's also interesting to get involved in the research and to be able to bring those stories to the public. It's maybe not the best academic career at the moment, just because academic opportunities as a whole are somewhat limited. But for archaeologists particularly, an awful lot of what we do is not in the academic realm. It's in the realm of business archaeology, of what we call cultural resource management, which is doing this archaeology in advance of construction. And about 40% of all the jobs in archaeology in the United States are in cultural resource management. So that does give an opportunity for an avenue to think about a career. And I know that a number of the universities across New York State are actually starting to incorporate teaching something about cultural resource management, how to organize a project, what the different stages are, what the federal laws are, to help students who think they're interested in archaeology actually get started in the field.
What's a good educational route?
You want to at least have your bachelor's and your master's, and that's because those are necessary to work on federal and state contracts. They expect you to at least have that level of education and experience. It's part of the regulations that come out of the New York State Office of Parks, which mirrors what the National Park Service says people should have. Beyond that, get on a dig as soon as you can and see if you one, really like it. I've had students come when I ran different field schools, and they wanted to be an archaeologist, and they got out in the field the first day, and they discovered that really, they didn't like being dirty, and they didn't like
That's
bugs.
Probably good to know that early on, yes.
But it's a good way to find out if you like it, and also if it's something that really you have a gift for, or whether maybe your gifts lie in some other area. There are lots of actual areas where archaeology really needs people that aren't necessarily pushing a shovel. People to work in GIS and graphic information systems, people to work on the environmental side of sites, as a couple of early callers asked. These are big and upcoming areas where if you're interested in archaeology, you can really make a good contribution without having to get out and get bug-eaten and sunburned and use your trowel.
Catherine, a listener named Catherine, wrote to the program and was interested to know if there are big archaeological digs going on that are still looking for human ancestors, et cetera. I assume that's always happening, but I don't know. She's curious about that.
In New York State?
And I don't think she means here. I think she means around the world. But I don't
know. Yes, there are. Certainly there are excavations that are going on still looking into the question of our earliest human ancestors. And in fact, it feels like every week a new set of fossils are turned up that readjusts our view of how the ancestral timeline works. One of the ways that we most commonly end up finding human ancestors is actually through construction projects, though, and not through research digs. And these are accidental finds. We don't know that they're going to be there, but when you start looking for whatever's there in the past, that comes up as well.
And at least they're asking you to do that.
Well, not in Africa, but in New York State, yeah.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. But before we let you go, then we'll let our audience know that Ann Morton from Morton Archaeological Research Service is presenting tonight at the Rochester Museum and Science Center at 7:30. Tickets range from $13 to $15. If you're a member of the Rochester Museum and Science Center, $13. General public, $15. Students, $7 and $8. And the presentation at 7:30 this evening. It's a nice, relaxed setting. They brought in a really interesting speaker circuit this year, as they always do. And so Ann will be out there tonight. Thrilled to have your time on this here. And
thank you for asking me.
You saw the interest in our audience on what's beneath our feet. I'll close by asking this. I could bump into a mastodon at some point around here. It could actually happen.
It could actually happen.
It could
yes.
actually happen.
It could actually happen.
Not that far down.
Not that far down, no.
Mastodons were how old?
12,000 years, 12, roughly.
12,000 years. And so still evidence of among us. So when you think about archaeology, it's changed my view a lot on what archaeology means this hour. Anne, thank you. And
thank you.
And have a nice evening tonight at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. And thanks for all of the great calls and questions this hour as we've been talking about our local history. Val LaBanca, thanks for being a great engineer. And I'm going to talk to you on Friday. It's the fifth Friday of the month. It's just a regular old Connections tomorrow. We will talk to you at noon Friday.